Okay, so there was a bit of a non-recording off mic chat in which BB's audio kept failing, and then we finally got it to work, and I said something like, these days, or what was it? It was like, you know, elephant safety gone up for dogs, and I found out that up for dogs actually isn't a phrase.
It's not,
It's gone to the dogs, but nothing has gone up for dogs, except I realized in the area that I live in beautiful grey South London, the area that I live in used to be very famous for breeding fighter dogs, not just fighter dogs, but like the UFC version of fighter dogs, to which you said,
Ultimate Fighting Chien. That's what I said right. to that. And I was happy with
and
it.
And I.
Okay, can we, can we pause for 1 second? I have spilt some nail polish on the table. I need to get it up before it stains. One minute. Okay, we're good.
All right. Okay, so Ultimate Fighting Chien.
Ultimate Fighting Chien, which is French for dog.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I do remember like very basic GCSE French.
Yeah, and that's the first thing. That's the first thing. If I remember correctly, I mean, I don't know. I mean, obviously, Hussein and I both went to grammar school, and are therefore extremely uncomradely. So I don't know what it was like to learning French at your school, but at my school, the first thing they taught us was to find out where your nearest dogfight was.
I mean, because it wasn't the same with mine, like, but my first, yeah.
That's like useful information. Like, I go to France, like, I don't need to ask to go swimming or to go to the disco or to jouer au tennis. All I want to know is where I can see a pair of dogs killing each other in a basement.
Yeah, all you want to find out is where you can find the killer dogs, where you can get your pamplemousse, and where you can have a l'affaire with a 19-year-old student of analytic philosophy at the Sorbonne.
That's right. Where you can buy bathrobes and watch dogs kill each other. That's what you go to France for.
My first interaction with dogs, was with fighter dogs, funnily enough. As I mentioned, I grew up in an area where like you had the kind of like UFC of dogs. And I remember I was like playing outside one of the estates one time. And I don't know how old I was, but all I remember was this, it was kind of physically small, but it was like one of those really hench, you could see their muscles. Mm. Like, this is a dog that has been bench pressing, absolutely, which I find both a hilarious image, but also a terrifying one.
Of course.
And the owner said the very characteristic thing of like, oh, it's not going to hurt you. It's fine, you know, just be nice to it, pet to it. It's like, your dog is like snarling at me, and I can see how sharp its teeth is, and like, it's eyes look angry. Like, this is not a dog that wants to play with me, and if it does want to play with me,
it wants to play with you in the way that like big like cats play with their food. Like, it will enjoy the playtime, but you won't.
It doesn't want to play with me, it wants to play with my bones, which yeah. funnily enough is also a threat that I got from a teenage K-pop stan this week. And I'm not going to mention any names because I don't know what's going to happen, but they will absolutely like, I don't know, find this and
they
will
have
like
got, they have got voice recognition now.
I wouldn't be surprised.
They've got this whole kind of like 8-to-8 kind of, sort of MI6 in the 60s set up whereby they can detect waves if you even like saying the name. Like, the next big startup is going to be detecting the brain waves that your brain makes, the shape of them that it makes when you even think
about saying one of their names.
Even, yeah, if you even think about it. So,
yeah.
I don't, because I, of the many, many, given my, you know, given my, given my political leanings and my absolute inability not to run my mouth and my also inability not to make dumb jokes about everything, you know, there are many ways in which I could sort of come a cropper, but I absolutely refuse to come to harm because of some teenage pop fans. That may well be the funniest possible timeline and the most ridiculous, but I simply refuse the indignity. So we're not going to talk about it anymore. Let's talk about Bolivia instead.
Yeah, like there are other ways that you could die a noble post's death, and yeah. being murdered by stans like isn't one of them.
It's definitely not one of them. Particularly since their murder threats are like they're very explicit. They're very kind of Jesus Christ. What's the matter with you? Back in the day, we'd say hush your mouth, or we'll be around there and we'll kick your head in for you. But these kids, they've got all kinds of fantasy murder scenarios.
Yeah, I mean, this is the legacy of like Wattpad and like fanfic websites and stuff, right?
Uh huh.
You can come up with like lots of creative ways of how you can murder people for even saying like something mildly like not even critical. You could just like murder like very, very creative ways of murdering someone who just says your fave's name.
I don't know what fanfic is because I've had sex, so I don't really know what it involves. But is that part of it? I thought it was like getting your I thought it was just like getting your faves to fuck. I thought that's what fanfic was.
I mean, lots of fanfic still is, but like as the discourse has sort of grown, there are like lots of every month there's like some type of discussion about like whether it's kind of whether you're a pedophile if you make two very fictional characters like kiss each other and one of those characters is 6 months older than the other. there's lots of discourses around like, you know, is it okay to like make a sexually undefined character cis when
I think it's author, I think never it, mentioned I, it. I think it's really cute that they spend so much of their time getting worked up about whether or not age gaps between fictional characters is grooming and is abusive, but they think absolutely nothing of threatening to go round to an actual person's house and remove the skin from their face and like wear it as a hat or whatever. And I think, I'm sure that says something about the relationship between effect and affect, which is produced by constantly posting. But I'm too busy trying not to upset teenagers.
Veering into very dangerous territory. I think K-pop will be like another one of those subjects that we never talk about, along
simply
with like
never
critical
talk about
theory.
We're never touching politics. Critical race theory. We're never touching politics. We're never touching the internal mechanisms of the Labour Party.
I mean, the Labour Party is like, you know, the Labour Party is a very, very old party. And touching it, I don't know, that's kind of sus.
It feels a little bit sus. There is a significant age gap between me and the Labour Party. So if they try and make me talk about them, that is grooming. So you back off, Keir.
That's right.
Keir and gang.
That's completely correct. so we should get on with the episode.
We should get on with the episode. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. I mean, I don't know whether like... I don't know whether you had any kind of stories about your family sort of telling you that Halloween was a haunted pagan tradition that you should ignore at all costs?
No, my parents think that it is a preposterous Americanism. So coming at it from a slightly different angle. But if you ask them at the right time, then you get to hear some pretty interesting thoughts about cultural imperialism, which
it's definitely
something when you're 10.
Yeah, whereas with my extended family, Halloween is very much like, it's just like a haunted pagan holiday that you shouldn't be like coaxed into, because if you celebrate it, then you're actually committing like a lot of sin, because you shouldn't be replicating holidays that aren't like Islamic holidays.
That's right.
So
honestly, that sounds fair. Do you have a kind of an Islamic Halloween? Is there a dress up? Is there
No, but like in lots of Islamic scripture, there is kind of always, you never dress up. That's one, you never dress up.
We have a Halloween. We have Purim, which is
interesting.
Which
okay, is so what
Jewish,
do you, what
Jewish
do you do?
Halloween? It's not,
what do you do during that?
It's partly celebrate it with dressing up as different characters. It celebrates the successful tricking of the Persian king by his Jewish wife Esther, who saved her people through a this is where I reveal myself to be so unbelievably scripturally ignorant. That's roughly what happened. You dress up and eat snacks. There aren't any ghosts, at least not to my knowledge.
Just another story about dudes that get let down despite wanting to do the best for everyone.
Yeah, I feel like that's definitely not the takeaway of the Persian king. it's been a long time since I've read this story, but I'm pretty sure that's not right.
there are lots of like Islamic ghost stories around like jinns and everything, and like there are some evil jinns, but there are like some good ones as well.
Jinns are like so genies. Genies, right? Aren't they the things that live in the desert and go, no?
I mean, there are a couple, but there are like, it refers more to like spirits, and you can have like different forms of jinns and stuff, okay. And some of them can possess you. So you can like have to get them removed, but some of them are like very helpful, and some of them are kind of there to like protect you and stuff like that. Okay. So, I mean, I don't know too much about the lore of jinns and everything,
that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, but you never like you don't dress up as them because they don't have like any sort of physical form, right?
Oh, do they not? There's a film, like a really dumb like kind of blockbuster sci-fi film where they meet a djinn in the desert, and it's got kind of blue glowing eyes, and it goes like that.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I haven't seen that. I wouldn't be surprised.
I think it might be in one of the newer Star Trek, which I definitely haven't seen because I'm too cool.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking you were like doing a bit where you were actually going to say, oh, I think it's called like Aladdin.
No. He's also blue, isn't he?
The most haunted, djinn is Will Smith as the genie.
Okay. Like, all right. First of all, I saw the live action Aladdin and I thought it was actually pretty fun. I enjoyed it.
I'm sure it was a fine movie.
I had a good time.
But like Will Smith, like just looking, a blue Will Smith with like protruding nipples is something that, and like the weird kind of beard, like the type of beard that you would see from the guy who runs the local vape shop in your derelict high street.
It's utterly perverse. I'm not saying it wasn't perverse, but I feel like people who like adults who have any particular protective feelings about Disney and Disney films should be subjected to the highest form of ridicule. but I just had this like idea about there being like a sort of a murderous axis of like adult Disney fans. Yeah. So like people who kind of lurk around waiting for someone to say, you know what, I actually quite liked the sequel to The Lion King, and then they go around to their house with like a machete.
Yeah, I mean, we may not have those types of Disney fans, or we might do, and we just haven't seen them. But they definitely exist in like for other Disney properties, i.e., like Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
Where
Star Wars fans are nuts.
And I guess even now, if you kind of even remotely say that, oh yeah, I didn't think the sequels were like bad. Like there are definitely people that will like act almost like the aforementioned stands that we're not going to talk about in terms of how they respond to you. Except instead of like being kind of unhinged teenagers, they're like middle-aged men who all have YouTube videos where like they have all their like giant toy collections in the background. That's cool. And like they spend all of their time like talking about how like the social justice warriors are the reason why we had this rubbish girl Jedi and all that stuff.
That's sick. That rules. I love that. I just like my main goal in life is to maybe know the love of an adult man with toys.
Do you know one adult guy who does make all his toys?
I feel like this is a trap. Go on.
It's Francis Fukuyama, the guy that we're supposed to be talking about right now.
Yeah, that's right. He does.
That's right. We're steering the show back.
We're back on course. Should we introduce ourselves?
That's right. We are talking. Oh, yeah. Well, we can do. My name is Hussein. You can follow me at H Kazvani. You already know this. If you follow the show, like, you know who I am. But
if you're a new listener, Hussein evidently doesn't understand the rules of soap opera writing. If you're a new listener, that's Hussein. I'm Phoebe. You can follow me on Instagram at Phoebe_Rosa_Holly. And we are the hosts of 10,000 Posts.
Yes, 10,000 Posts.
How's it going?
It's a show about posts. I mean, look, I'm still kind of like...
Except today it's 10,000 Ghosts.
10,000 Ghosts. Oh, that's a good title.
Yeah.
It's fine. I mean, like, you know, I'm still kind of, you know, still a bit shaken up by my confrontation with like K-pop teams, but I'm fine. I'm okay.
I just like, honestly, like, in a way, like I'm jealous a little of, well, I'm not jealous because I think they're losers, but I'm jealous of anyone who like cares about something or believes in something enough that they are willing to publicly in quite a self-abnegating and self-humiliating way, and like that they're willing to like publicly post cringe but murderous cringe. And I have a lot of respect, like, just because like so much of what we do like day in, day out is just like predicated on just like endless kind of sort of exhausted sneering and exhausted cynicism. And this kind of belief is almost something admirable. And it's a shame that it can't be channeled into something which isn't so fucking stupid.
Yeah.
And isn't just behaving like a mental person online.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a lot of like organizational energy in these young people, which is being wasted a little.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we spoke a little bit about kind of, you know, that moment of, and again, we shouldn't like focus too much on this, but I will kind of make this point, which is that we spoke a little bit about that moment when the whole thing around like, oh, leftist and K-pop teens can like are like natural allies, and therefore, because K-pop teens are like super well organized. And here's the thing, they are really well organized. I remember like working on this story, but I didn't quite make it into being published. But it was looking at like the inner workings of how K-pop teens sort of like organize. And it was really intricate. I spoke to this account that like had like multiple like databases, and these are like not just kind of very basic Excel spreadsheets, they're very kind of well-made complicated databases in which they analyze every bit of like K-pop band related content in like multiple languages, and then they do their own like fact checks on them, and they will like go after any journalist that like even mistranslates anything that like has been said. And they like do shifts. So like, you know, when the Americans are up, and obviously the British people are kind of asleep, but like, you know, once the Americans are asleep, the British people will be back up. And then you have like various people from lots of different countries, like India, the Middle East, etc. And they all kind of like use these types of databases and all these networks in order to like track all this stuff. it's like a very, like, if we're talking about online activism and organization, K-pop teens like really have it down to a T. But the thing is, like, they're not using it for like societal change or like political or anything.
No, they
have one, and to give them credit, like, you know, they haven't set their, like, the way in which they're organized and the ambitions that they have are like very, very realistic. Like, they are all unified around this one goal, which is that like BTS or whatever kind of K-pop band needs to be always trending number one on Spotify. And if anyone talks shit about any of them, they will regret it for the rest of their lives.
I mean, in a way, like, they're kind of protectionist sort of tactics are, it seems like a little bit dramatic to say it, but they are terrorist tactics. Because because if you're behaving in such a way that you are requiring fully grown professional adults to very, very carefully involve themselves in a kind of reverence about teenage pop fans, because otherwise they could actually come to material harm. How is that not a terrorist tactic? Mm-hmm. Like, it's, I mean, the problem is because of the way that the way that things have been framed over the last say 20 years or so. I mean, if we take 9/11 as a watershed point in terms of like how people think about and characterize terroristic activities, because they obviously it existed, like the idea of terrorism existed for decades and decades before that, but in terms of it sort of coalescing in terms of being events that could shape geopolitics and could shape domestic policy and internal kind of matters of sort of culture and sort of social cohesion, people have been trained to think of terrorism and terrorist tactics as at the very least something serious and something connected to a life or death and serious situation. I don't mean situation quite, but I mean, if you are committing a terrorist act because you believe, say, for example, in white genocide, or you commit a terrorist act because you believe it is what God wants you to do to cleanse the earth of sin and build an ordered and traditional and just society, just to kind of wipe the slate clean. And, you know, that's really serious stuff. So people are slower to identify the same tactics being used in the service of something which they don't find serious. Just because the content is serious doesn't mean the tactics aren't, and doesn't mean that they're not the same tactics. I think a journalist would be like five years ago, there was the idea that a journalist who even posted sort of sympathy and solidarity with the staff of Charlie Hebdo, that they would be then next the Islamists coming for them. And I think people now, maybe less so in the last few weeks, but I think people now, certainly journalists, would be much less inclined to poke the hornet's nest of this online fandom than they would ISIS, because you say one thing about ISIS, their internal COVID management policies have been spot on. They've been doing everything they can to protect their people because they have the infrastructure.
And at this point, we have to bring up a drill tweet, we do not have to hand it. By no means do we have to hand it to ISIS. what was the tweet? I'm gonna let me.
You don't under any circumstances have to hand it to them.
I'm gonna read it now just because it's really funny. So just to clarify on this side, because as the army of marauding K-pop teens like suddenly searches to find our properties, I just need to make this very clear, and I'm gonna make this very clear using the drill tweet, which is issuing a correction on a previous post of mine regarding the terror group ISIL. You do not, under any circumstances, quote, got to hand it to them.
It's a good tweet.
That's right. And do you know who else, who would agree with that statement?
Who?
Francis Fukuyama.
Francis Fukuyama.
Why are we talking about Francis Fukuyama?
We are talking about Francis Fukuyama because it is Halloween. Yeah. And Francis,
and he did like one of the best Halloween tweets.
He did, world. And okay, so Francis Fukuyama, just like a little bit of background, he's a political scientist, he's a writer, and he's best known for his book, which is called The End of History, which he wrote in 1992. And if we just a little bit about 1992, first of all, as we all know, according to the law of this pod, that is the last time I willingly learn anything. That's the last time I willingly learn a piece of new information which didn't delete an old piece of information. That's what happened in 1992. So in many ways it was the end of history. It was when my memory card was full and I had to start and I had to start really being very ruthless
Well, you were very characteristic, which is that like you're like rather than upgrade your RAM, take more memory, you were like, just gonna stay here.
I will not pay 70 pence a month for more memory. No, I will not, and you cannot make me. And that's directly to the ghost of Steve Jobs.
Boosting your computer memory back in the 90s was pretty expensive.
That's true.
Sense.
Well,
the principle applies, which is that we don't, on this show, we don't believe in upgrades.
We don't know. Some other stuff that happened in 1992, I made a papier-mâché puppet of John Major for a school craft display of some description. And then my teacher asked me if it was my grandfather, because we all had to make these puppets. And she said, is that your granddad? And I said, no, it's John Major. and so that, so these are just things that happened in 1992. I think we can agree that is infinitely more important than Francis Fukuyama's alleged book, The Alleged End of History.
That's right.
Which, like, honestly, I think publishing a book in 1992 called The End of History, I feel like that, and saying 1992 is the end of history, I feel that's academically, I feel that's quite large behavior, because I feel like I would maybe wait a couple of years and see if it really was the end of history before bringing my book out, because I would be so fucked off if I'd written my book about how it's the end of history.
And then some more
history happened. Like, for example, in 1994, I hit another child in my class over the head with a recorder because they told me that I had been incorrectly given my handwriting pen. Did they do this at your school? Okay. Did they do this at your school with the handwriting pen, where you had to write when you had to write in pencil, and then when your handwriting was neat enough, you got upgraded to a pen?
I mean, my handwriting has never been neat, but I do remember that like we were all issued like the Beryl handwriting pen, which I still use to this day.
Okay, so. I'd love a Beryl handwriting pen. I was the first person in my class to be allowed to move on to the pen. Thank you.
Bad.
Look, I'm sorry. Sometimes when you are a woman and you will be familiar with this. You are standing there and you are the most qualified person to take your pen, and then some man who can barely write in a straight line gets given his pen before you. And I think every woman will be very sympathetic to that. I was the first person in my class to get given a pen. And this other kid was like, I should have got my pen first. So I hit him over the head with a recorder. And I hit him harder than I intended to, and made his head start kind of bleeding. And you know, when you have a head wound, it's very dramatic because it bleeds very freely. But I didn't get into trouble because of institutionalized misogyny. It was assumed that a sweet 8-year-old girl wasn't capable of physically attacking another child with a recorder. And this is exactly the kind of sexism that we stand against on this pod. So yeah, so that's like another item of history that took place. And I feel like Francis Fukuyama would feel pretty fucking stupid at not including this in his book.
That's right. He published a book without realizing, but like somewhere in North London, there was some drama regarding a Beryl handwriting pen.
Exactly.
And if you use this as like the beginning of like history too, there is a straight line that is drawn with said Beryl pen that leads directly to 9/11.
Absolutely. And like, I don't know, some like other stuff happened around that kind of time in like the Balkans, I think. I feel like something significant happened in the Balkans.
Yeah, some stuff happened there. I read it in this magazine called Living. Yeah, I read about some stuff in this magazine. I don't know if you've heard about it, called Living Marxism.
Oh my God.
Interesting stuff.
Interesting stuff.
Interesting stuff.
I mean, according to Living Marxism, nothing happened in the Balkans and nothing to see here. So.
They were like, look, we are hearing that stuff is happening. However, we have read Francis Fukuyama's book, The End of History. And look, we are taking it. There is no more history. What the fuck are you talking about?
The unlikely intellectual meeting of minds between Francis Fukuyama and the good people of Living Marxism magazine. Because, yeah, they said, well, we've looked at it. We've read the book. We've read The End of History. So nothing can possibly be happening in the Balkans because history's ended. So there we go. He was a member of the Rand Corporation. He's a
great woodworker.
He is a great woodworker. I actually really want to talk about his woodwork as a kind of separate thing because I feel like it's important. He was a key contributor to the Reagan Doctrine. So he's a key figure in Reaganism. He's a key figure in neoconservatism. So I think that I feel pretty confident saying that I probably wouldn't enjoy a conversation with him on most subjects. I could be wrong.
Also, I mean, one subject which you might feel like you would have a fun conversation with is based on his tweet. So I'm considering that we are now half an hour into the show. We should really read the tweet out.
Yes.
If you're up for it. Okay, so Francis Fukuyama, given the intro to what he's about, on October the 11th, 2018, he posted this. Just passed the house with a child skeleton as a Halloween decoration. People should realize that these are not cute. When you see one in reality, it is at minimum a human tragedy and at worst a hashtag war crimes. 588 quote tweets. This is before quote, like, quote tweets were a thing. Francis Fukuyama, funnily enough, like leans into it a lot. So like last October, he quote tweeted his own tweet saying, this tweet gets re-upped every Halloween. So posting for it, 488 retweets, 1.1 likes, a great post from a cool guy. So what are your initial reactions to Francis's Halloween post?
My initial reactions is it's the same as it is whenever I see whenever I see a kind of curious and eccentrically worded tweet by whatever one might think of his leanings, I think that neoconservatism is one of the single most damaging ethoses, which has sort of ever existed. I mean, if you look at something like Iran-Contra and the knock-on effects and the kind of the actors involved in Iran-Contra, who are still the same actors who were involved in sort of literally everything from that point onwards. I mean, Reaganism and neoconservatism, I feel pretty confident saying were bad. I'm happy saying that. I'm happy to say that they were bad. But he's still probably a pretty smart guy. I mean, I might describe him as maybe not a very good guy, but he's definitely a smart guy. So why he'd be driven to post is really anybody's guess. But yeah, so my reaction is the same as it always is when I see these kinds of respected public intellectuals, respected academics, respected political scientists being lured in by the siren song of the post. Is at first I think, well, what the fuck is that? And secondly, I think, is he right? I honestly don't know, because obviously there are significant cultural differences in terms of not just cultural but kind of historical and contextual differences in terms of the display of the dead.
Yeah.
Right? And the display of dead bodies. If you look at one of those really, really fancy like medieval reliquaries that have little bits of bone in them, they're spooky objects. And if you look at skulls as memento mori in art, and that's not about veneration and reverence for the dead. And you look at the display, of mummies in museums, there's no reverence there. People kind of sort of wander past them like a group of sheep and kind of look at them and go, oh god, that person's dead as fuck. That person is just so fucking super dead. They're all kind of leathery and super dead. And there was in the late 19th century, early 20th century, there was a significant market of fake mummies that British aristocrats would buy. And would buy an important ship from Egypt, and they were just recently dead people who had been treated and kind of shriveled up so that they looked like a very ancient mummy, and they would bring them out at their dinner parties and unwrap them. So that's not veneration, is it? That's not it's not even particularly squeamish or delicate. But whether children divorcing the idea of a skeleton having once been a person with the idea of it's just a kind of spooky thing to put in your front garden for Halloween is, I don't think it's an uninteresting philosophical point, but he has phrased it in such an eccentric way.
Yeah.
And I think that the most eccentric element of it, first of all, is saying that people should realize they're not cute. I don't think anyone has ever used a skeleton decoration because they thought it was cute. It's supposed to be scary, right?
I don't know. There was that Disney Pixar. I mean, so 2018. So there was that Disney Pixar movie in which it's set in the Festival of the Dead in Mexico.
Mona.
No, it's
no, isn't that what it's called?
No. Edit that bit out. It's not called Mona. What's it called?
It's called Coco.
Mona's a different
picture. No, it's called, I'm looking at it right now, it's called Coco.
The reason I don't know the difference, it's genuinely not a kind of matter of cultural disrespect, is because I just don't know anything about recent Pixar films, because,
okay,
again,
I'll jump in.
I'm an adult.
No, I'll jump in now.
Yeah.
I'll jump in now. So this is after you say, like, skeletons aren't cute, to which I say, no, I would.
Okay, yeah, so, yeah, so, yeah.
So this tweet was done in 2018, and the thing that I'm thinking about is that he's looking into a house, and they've got memorabilia, or they've got like merchandise from the Disney Pixar movie Coco, which was produced in 2017, and was a very, very popular kids movie about a young Mexican boy who travels to like another world during like the Festival of the Dead. So
oh, is that what it's about? Is that what it's about? I've not seen it.
I did see it in 2018. I can't remember the whole story, but like anyone who's like seen it will sort of know what I'm talking about. Like, you know, he goes into this other world, and he meets a lot of people who are like just these like skeletons, but they're like very cute skeletons and very like, you know, they're funny looking and everything. And the whole idea is that like, you know, death isn't something that you mourn, but it's something that you like celebrate because of all the kind of like mysticism and myths around like passing and death in Latin culture. Mm. So when this movie came out and it was really popular, like obviously Disney being Disney, like flooded the market with like merchandise, and every Halloween they do this. Like I was in a newsagent today, and they had like lots of kind of like Coco related like candies and everything. So my thinking is that he's like walking down a suburban street in like Palo Alto where he lives, and he's seen like a family who's got like a bunch of merchandise from the Disney movie Coco, and he's gotten incredibly upset about it. And he's really outraged that Disney would make a movie which would show skeletons not just being cute, but being like pogs, you know, like a fat ass. Like there are skeletons in that movie.
I beg your pardon.
Yeah, I'm not joking. There's like there are like some incredibly sexy looking skeletons in that movie.
There are some incredible. Okay, you know what? I just want to make this just 100% clear. Home Office, we know you're listening. I'd like to dissociate myself from my co-host. This is nothing to do with me, and I will testify against it.
Yeah, I mean, this also touches on something that you were talking to me about the other day. I feel like we need to address like now, because otherwise I'll forget, which is about like the politics of fancying ghosts.
Yeah, that's right.
And
how, okay, first, and how, right, first and of all, like first of all, there is absolutely no way of evening up the power dynamic between you and a ghost. Because first of all, we've got the age gap. And second, if we're talking about power dynamics, what could be more powerful than being able to like pick up a can of Monster Energy, put it to your lips and drink? Now, a ghost can't do that. With the best will in the world, right. A ghost cannot do that. So it may be older than you. So it may have the implicit power of that dynamic embedded there, but it can't pick up a can of Monster Energy drink and drink it. So you are the one who is exploiting the power dynamic with the ghost.
Right, because that's ableism, right?
First of all, it's ableism. Second, it's alivism. It's ectoplasmism. It's ectoplasmism. And I'm very sick of people not recognizing that there's just no way of not having a mutually abusive relationship with a ghost. And for that matter, you can't have a non-abusive sexual encounter with a ghost, because how's that going to work? You can't even touch them. Every time you touch them, you're going to put your hand right through them. And quite honestly, who do you think you are to just go putting your hand through someone?
Yeah.
So yeah, there's just some very complicated dynamics, which I just don't feel like have been addressed at all. Like one day.
That's right.
One day we will talk about how relationships with ghosts are just the most abusive way that you can possibly conduct a relationship.
Yeah. Maybe this Halloween I might just do a tweet, which is like one of those very sincere like ones where it's like, we don't like, something like, you know, it's problematic to have relationships, romantic relationships with ghosts, but you y'all aren't ready to talk about that yet. With like a
sexual relationships as well. And also, like, again, you have to remember as well that the ghosts are not innocent in this. Like, if a ghost haunts you, then that is that is supernatural grooming.
That's right. Yeah. If you're a ghost and you decide to like watch someone that is like considerably younger than you, just because you think that like their scent is appealing, like that is extremely problematic.
Just because you feel entitled to imbibe the scent of their still living flesh and hear their still pounding heart doesn't mean that that's an acceptable thing to do.
I'm thinking about want to do like turf posts, like the ones that are like really extremely kind of concerned about bathrooms, but making it about ghosts and how every person deserves an individual bathroom because they deserve a safe space away from ghosts.
To be fair, there are a lot of, I think they're like particularly like kind of Japanese folk horror stories about ghosts in bathrooms, like ghosts.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Like
yeah.
Ghosts in like public bathrooms. It's a really, really interesting kind of repeated folkloric preoccupation. And
well, you know, what else are they gonna do?
What if you're a ghost? If you're a ghost, would you hang around in a public bathroom?
Oh no, see, I used to think about this a lot. If I was a ghost, where would I hang out? And I didn't really come up with a lot of options. My things were just kind of like maybe like at like Clapham Infernos.
I would hang out in the most like kind of brightly lit, brightly colored, confectedly cheery places in the world. Like I'd like haunt Borley McBallison.
Yeah. And no, I would go to Berghain. I'd go to Berghain every day. If I was a ghost, I would go to Berghain every day.
To be fair, if you're a ghost, you don't need sleep.
That's true.
And you could just go right through the walls.
Right, and Sven couldn't really kind of like critique you in any way because like you would be like innovative, and you could also say that like if you don't let me in, I will haunt you and your wife, forever.
You could do that, but I mean, then you'd be then.
Sven,
you, then
Sven, you would, Sven wouldn't be scared. Yeah, Sven wouldn't be scared. He would just be bored.
But then you'd be guilty of supernatural grooming. So I don't know how we're squaring that. What is the way of like as a ghost?
Cancel ghosts for being a ghost.
Cancel ghosts, first of all. what is, if you're a ghost, the ethical way of entering Berghain? Because first of all, you are entering that horrifying sounding Berlin super club without its consent for a kickoff. You have to ask a building for its consent before you go into it.
Yeah,
that's right. I feel like we've got a little bit sidetracked, but I just feel like ghosts have got too much of an easy ride in terms of talking about the emotional labor that they expect us to perform on their behalf. the constant kind of the constant looking around and the is this place haunted and the let's go to the graveyard and the it's so scary, like that is emotional labor. Every single bit of that is emotional labor. Like if a ghost great. Like knocks a cup off your shelf and you freak out, think how much emotional labor, think how draining that is for an introvert to have to perform to that level just for a much older person, a much older thing that really should know better before taking advantage of you, a 30-year-old person who posts all day. That's all I'm saying. All I'm saying.
Okay.
Should we go back to the tweet?
My initial thought on Fukuyama, beyond the fact that he's getting mad at like Disney movies,
is it definitely Disney paraphernalia, or are you just inferring based on the year?
I'm inferring, but I think that like I wouldn't be surprised if it did turn out to be the truth, because I think that like after that movie came out, I definitely noticed like a lot of skeleton like decorations that were basically from that movie. Because again, it's one of Pixar's like most popular movies, right? But in any case, like the idea of like the kind of quote like cute skeleton is, especially when he says like children skeleton as well. So I don't think what he means is skeleton of a child, but just like a small skeleton.
I was reading it as like the skeleton belonged, like the decoration belonged to a child, but does it mean the skeleton of a child?
Well, this is the thing. Like, I think what he actually means is that he saw a small skeleton and inferred that was a child. And then that took him back to like his days at the Rand Corporation, where again, like the 90s and the early 2000s, when like the Rand Corporation was like the think tank that like American like Department of Homeland Security and stuff would go to on all these affairs. Like they were dealing with like lots of kind of, you know, they were dealing with lots of like micro wars, and they were dealing with you know, civil wars in like post-Soviet countries. You know, Francis Fukuyama has done did field work in those places. So like undoubtedly I think he has seen like at least pictures of lots of casualties. And I think that like must be something that's really kind of like haunted him for a while. So in many ways, like I read that and I feel quite sorry for him, because you know, this is someone who's like very much like stuck in not just like his prime years as like the public intellectual. Because bear in mind that like, you know, we laugh a lot about the end of history, but like he was like the kind of prime intellectual for that short period of time. And then in a matter of like moments, he was like laughed at, like because inevitably like history happened. And I wondered to myself, like, does Francis Fukuyama curse his publisher like every fucking day for like making him go with that title?
Because I feel like insisting that he called it the end of history. Because
I remember.
Lad, are you sure about this? Because I'm pretty sure that history's going to keep happening.
I remember reading this book when I was in uni a couple of times. And in all fairness, like, it's not a bad book. And also, like, I think, and one of the reasons why he keeps saying, but yeah, well, I genuinely think that I was right in terms of my thesis, because his thesis wasn't that stuff will like not happen. His thesis was that history will always bend its way towards like liberal democracy, and that liberal democracy is kind of like the idealized structure of any state. And lots of things may happen, but ultimately we will always end up at that point, because we will realize that like that is the best way of organizing society. Now, I personally disagree with that thesis. I think that lots of other people disagree with that as well. But I think that it's a much like, when you look at it in terms of, and also like one thing that I think he's very prescient about is that even when liberal democracy is achieved, there is always this like existential problem of like people wanting to like fight for something or like be part of kind of localized communities. Or you know, stuff like that, and like people, and that often, and particularly young men, will kind of naturally veer towards violence as a way of trying to kind of achieve that. And I think that, like, you know, recent events over the past like 4 years, kind of, you know, there's like some truth to what he says. I don't think it's like, it's not a thesis that you would just like completely write off. Like, one thing to bear in mind is that one of, like, Francis Fukuyama's, like, most influential teacher was Samuel Huntington, who wrote the book Clash of Civilizations, which argued that, like, Western Christendom will always be at odds with, like, the Middle East and Islam and stuff like that. And his book is not only, like, more shaky, but it's also, like, way more reactionary. And yet Huntington, like, didn't suffer anywhere near the kind of reputational damage that Fukuyama did. And I wonder whether, like, Fukuyama is just sort of haunted by that period where he gets to live in this golden age, but only for, like, he was in the limelight for a very short period of time. And then he was sort of dismissed, despite the fact that, like, he was far more diligent and also far more conservative than his contemporaries.
Okay. I think I have a thought about this. I could be wrong. But it's a serious thought about how one of the interesting positives of the Trump administration, apart from obviously the fact that he rules and his post rule, I mean, he probably doesn't rule. No. He's a bad person, but they're all bad. They're all bad people. All American politicians are bad people, apart from Bernie, who I will continue to say is a good guy. Ignore that. One of the interesting positives is that it has made people, certainly it's made liberal leaning people and people who are apparently invested in liberal democracy as a kind of ideal norm to which to revert to. I was thinking about this because I was trying to think about how I could account for my positives of the Trump administration view to normal people who are not convinced by but who, like, totally rules. And, like, he's like a bi icon, and, like, look at his butt. Like, ordinary people are not convinced by this. I'm just putting it out there. You tell a normal, nice person that you think Trump rules, and you are, you're gonna be in trouble. You're gonna be in trouble in a social way, with them. Mm. So I was sort of trying to think of, like, how do I account for my it's not like pleasant surprise. That's not like a good way of putting it. But, like, it just it's just because the election coming up and we're in this weird flat time loop and stuff. But it just so feels like the last 4 years, there was so much that was threatened, which hasn't come to pass, and then stuff that we couldn't possibly have predicted, which has very much come to pass. But one positive of it is that it's made people more confident in identifying what the hallmarks of fascism and a fascist administration are. So they don't, right. So it's not so much anyone who disagrees with me is a fascist. It's much more they are able to look at practices that are carried out on a policy level and on a material level, and point to them and say, this is the act of a fascist regime. So the question is, and this is what I've been thinking about a lot, is whether, if Biden wins, whether they will be brave enough when these things continue to happen to continue to identify them as fascist practices.
Right.
And I think that honestly, I don't think they will. I mean, the practice of sterilizing women in immigration detention centers started under Obama, and not only was it not known about, it was certainly not described as a fascist act or the act of a fascist administration. But it is. There's no other way of describing it. Just from on every single, both sort of practical and ethical level, it is a fascist thing to do, to imprison migrants and forcibly sterilize them. There's no non-fascist argument for it. So I'd be very interested to see if the cheerleaders of liberal democracy, if Biden wins, would be brave enough to continue to recognize it, or whether or not their kids in cages and Trump is a fascist and this is fascism, is just pure sloganeering. And it makes me wonder whether, when people like Fukuyama talk about reversion to liberal democracy as a sort of natural norm, as having its own kind of like interior social and cultural logic, and it's the natural way in which societies collapse and organize themselves along, is whether what they actually mean is societies naturally look for figures which don't shine a light on practices and behaviors and structures which are and the material reality of people's lives which are antagonistic to the very concept of liberal democracy. So that he's right in the very kind of vulgar and crude sense that people, as soon as there's a kind of recognizable figure, they will tell themselves that this is liberal democracy. And so he's not quite saying that liberal democracy is the natural, natural order, but as long as there's no public vulgarity, and as long as things look as they're supposed to look, and the way that people are used to things looking, as long as a politician looks and behaves and talks like a politician, that's functionally the same thing, and they are satisfied that it's less that liberal democracy is the natural order, and more that it's very easy to satisfy people that liberal democracy is taking place.
Yeah, I think it's like we spoke about this, I think, ages ago, but it was the idea of we didn't speak about this ages ago, but I think I spoke about it on Trash Future a while ago, which was how for lots of centrist, center left people who were quite big in the 90s and like the early 2000s, the kind of desirable state is one where like institutions sort of inform worth and value. So when people like Fukuyama, who like, you know, I'm looking at his timeline right now, and there's like, you know, a lot of his interviews about, you know, so he's done an interview with like Unheard where he's basically said that, you know, even if like Trump loses, the whole kind of notion of Trumpism will always be there, because, and his argument is that like Trump has done so much damage to like institutions, governmental bodies, that, you know, the legacy of Trump will kind of like stay regardless of what happens. You know, for him, it's very much like, you know, the Rand Corporation at that time is one which on the one hand is very libertarian, like it kind of takes a libertarian approach in the sense of, you know, the government should be limited, but where the government should act are places in like, you know, defense and international peacekeeping and stuff like that, where the kind of big militarized bodies of the state are very, very well funded and assertive, you know, because, and these are kind of signals of health of like, these are the kind of like institutions that you want to kind of maintain and build up. And what Fukuyama seems to lament in recent years is kind of how America's international standing has declined as a result of like Trump being very kind of fast and loose with like international norms. Never mind like, you know, the kind of the real kind of like big civil they were the big like civil rights breaches and like, you know, the increase of the surveillance state, and also like the fact that it's kind of untrue in the sense that like I was reading an article yesterday about how like if you look at kind of the war in Yemen, like Trump has kind of given not only more funding to like the Department of Defense, but also like has done twice as many drone strikes in Yemen as like the Obama administration did. So like if you kind of really boil it down, like what he's saying in reality is untrue, but what he's absolutely is talking about are again, we talk about like aesthetics, right? He's talking about the aesthetics and projection of those aesthetics on the state, and the fact that like Trump's kind of character and Trump's character kind of like illustrates the real ugliness of American power, which was always there, but was always kind of like masked behind
he's shone a light on institutional rot, which had not been shone before.
Yeah. And the thing about Francis Fukuyama is that because he was a RAND guy in the 90s, but he's just been a big think tank guy and a big university guy, is that like he was complicit in this, like the construction of this aesthetic, one which is like, you know, yeah, we got, you know, one which is like, yeah, America will kind of like conduct wars, but it will do so in like a way that is not only just, but like based in like academic theory and reason, evidence-based logic and reason, you know, and it will kind of like employ the use of like lots of scholarship from universities and think tanks to like inform its policy. And like, that's kind of where the really what he's lamenting is like the revolving doors that used to be, that he kind of really grew up in and really kind of appreciates. And I think he still like holds a lot of reverence for, you know, this is to say that like Francis Fukuyama, despite being kind of neoliberal, neoconservative, was more critical of the Iraq War than many of his contemporaries again.
Yeah.
Which is why he still kind of gets like some credit and like some kind of,
He also destroyed an SJW with facts and logic. So who's to say, this is dead interesting, but I also feel like I'm learning stuff and I don't, and I'm supposed to be
sound the alarm, sound the learning stuff.
I'm supposed to be seeing my partner later, and I'm really worried that I keep learning stuff, I'm going to forget where he lives. So that's no.
Yeah, and then he'll see you and be like, you know, why have you grown a foot taller?
Exactly, and he'll be like, at the weekend you were 5'2". Why are you now? Have you been listening to Jamila Jamil? And have you been learning and accruing extra inches as a result? I just want to go back. I want to go back to the tweet really quickly.
Yeah. What are your closing thoughts on the tweet?
My closing thoughts on the tweet is okay. Yeah. So like, obviously, if he saw some Disney Pixar tat, like marketing tat, and is using it to start a kind of philosophical discussion about what the correct way is to treat the dead and to look at the dead and to think in terms of human remains. And you know, this is something which we touched on in the Is Necrophilia Marxist episode. I don't know what I wanted my life to be like, but it certainly wasn't this. Which we sort of touched on. And it's like from a kind of cultural and philosophical perspective, it's not an uninteresting conversation, I don't think. And I also would be quite interested to think about, like, say, like, you know, that kind of Victorian mourning jewelry, which has like the lock of like a dead person's hair in it, and you're just like walking around with a brooch with like dead hair just in it, and that is not deemed to be kind of disrespectful and lack of veneration, but a kind of a plastic Disney skeleton is. And I think what is good about this is that he has chosen the worst possible delivery system for having this kind of discussion. And I think the idea of somebody having this long, respected, venerated academic and think tank career and still being like, I must post, is just, to me, objectively the funniest possible thing. To think that when you have access to so much in terms of formal and traditional platforming, like if Francis Fukuyama wanted to write a book about the politics of death and the politics of commemoration and burial and the culturally loaded ways in which we think about dead bodies and skeletons and corpses, etc., etc., etc. He could do that. He could get paid money to do it, and yet off he toddles to the timeline to make a post about it. And finally, I kind of want to talk about his furniture as well, but we're basically running out of time. And finally, it's that he has hashtagged it, war crimes. And so it's at minimum a human tragedy. He doesn't hashtag that. And at worst, a hashtag war crimes. So what he is thinking there is that someone is just on the timeline, scrolling, on the timeline, having a scroll. The stuff that they're seeing isn't sufficiently bad. It's not bad enough. So they're thinking, I wonder what's going on the old war crimes hashtag.
Yeah.
And this is what's going on the war crimes hashtag. In fact, actually, I'm going to click on the war crimes hashtag and see what else we've got.
While you're doing that, I just want to save it. Like, the most kind of like charitable reading of it is that like this is just, you know, Francis Fukuyama is a boomer and he's just like using Twitter as a way that boomers would. He's come to it very late. He's heard that like the thing about Twitter is that you use hashtags and that anything you're interested in, you just hashtag it and like people can find it, right? Mm. Which was like true back in, I don't know, 2009. Mm. If you look at like tweets from like 2009 to like maybe 11 or 12, there were lots of tweets that kind of like use that type of formatting where if someone used it now, you'd be like, number one, you don't need to use hashtags anymore. But number two, like it looks very weird and jarring now.
It does.
Back then, that is how the system worked. Yeah. So this could very much be like Francis Fukuyama has been very busy doing woodwork. He hasn't really been online very much, which like good for him. Mm-hmm. So the times where he does go online, because again, like Francis Fukuyama is also like a computer nerd. If you look on his Instagram, like he's not just doing woodwork. He's also like programming and he's learning how to like, you know, he has like a very big server at home. Which like if you own your own server in your own house, like, you know, that's like another level of being like a tech guy. He has enough equipment in his house.
I wish he'd just done his woodwork and not been one of the architects of Reaganism. Like that would be so much better. That's what I want for Francis Fukuyama. Francis, if you're listening.
What's the thing? Francis Fukuyama like exists. There's a duality to him. There's one which is like the Reaganite reactionary who like is not wholly responsible for like the failures of neoliberalism, but certainly was one of its like proponents and like chief, if not an architect, then like the structural engineer.
Certainly an architect. I think architect of Reaganism is a fair account.
Yeah. But like definitely like a proponent.
Yeah.
But then there's the other part of Francis Fukuyama, which is very much like someone who is just a little bit of a himbo, or someone who's just quite a wholesome guy.
Yeah, and he thinks it's gross and disrespectful to display dead bodies, and he does his woodwork and has his server. So inside him is two wolves.
And he loves taking pictures of like his kids, and like he loves taking bad pictures of his wife because again, men can't take pictures of their wives and girlfriends.
They cannot.
So he keeps capturing the gremlin or the goblin.
Yeah.
But if you look at his Instagram, if you just like knew Francis Fukuyama as an Instagram personality, you would think that he's just like a very wholesome guy who
you would think he was a woodwork influencer as a pro.
You would think.
As opposed to a neoconservative influencer, which is what he actually is.
Or a neo-Nazi woodworker, which I hope that one day we can get into because it's like such an amazing story.
I didn't know what you're talking about for a minute. It's just like I don't think it's fair to call him a neo-Nazi. Bloody hell! You're talking about the woodworking Nazi, which is a different guy, different types of guy.
But was an actual guy. So I think that there's this like this interesting duality to Francis Fukuyama as he exists at the moment. And it's one where like on the one hand he's stuck in like the glory days of the 90s and can't like quite get over that moment. But on the other hand, one where he has like boomer brain in the sense that like he loves he does love posting, but also he doesn't know how to do it. So as a result, what are kind of fairly earnest and quite normal tweets back in 2009 come across as very weird and jarring now.
Not jarring, exactly. Just eccentric.
Right. Right. Maybe. I mean, okay. I mean, we can probably end it there.
Yeah.
Okay. Unless there's anything else you want to say.
No, I personally
don't think that this belongs in like a pantheon of tweets.
A Halloween, but it is a Halloween tweet, and this is our Halloween special. Yeah. So
and it's a pretty good Halloween tweet. So I think that like I want to give credit to Francis Fukuyama as a poster.
Yeah.
For at least doing quite an innovative, formatted tweet, of which we were able to speak about it for like close to an hour.
I will finish off with saying one thing, which is that if you click on his war crimes hashtag, it just comes up with a little something went wrong error message and suggests that you retry. Wow. So
these days,
deep state.
Yeah, these days you can't even commit a war crime.
You can't even hashtag your war crimes.
I mean, I've searched it now, and like there are like definitely people. So like the president of Azerbaijan, for example, has used the hashtag war crimes.
Oh, good.
Tag. The president of Armenia has used it as well. Obvious for like.
I was going to say, is the president of Azerbaijan tweeting it in a kind of like, is that a brag? Is that like a sort of picture of him like, you know, doing a kind of thumbs up and then just hashtagging it war crimes?
Well, look, we're not taking sides only because learning about this war is like
there could be nothing worse than learning about this war. I think
So on this hashtag, there are a lot of hashtags about Armenia and Azerbaijan, a couple about like Pakistan. So like there are kind of like actual pictures of war going on, but the question again goes back to like who is searching for hashtag war crimes, and in the midst of like all these kind of videos about casualties in Armenia and Azerbaijan, you will find like Francis Fukuyama's like somewhere in the middle, just sort of fitting a bit oddly. It's quite weird looking at all these kind of images.
Wait, sorry, and, does he sit oddly? Francis Fukuyama, does he sit strangely? Is he another bi icon?
I don't know if he's a bi icon. I do know that he kind of like has a poster's posture, i.e. one that
kind of hunched over.
One that kind of like leans into a screen. Oh, and in the midst of it, again, if you look at the war crimes hashtag, if you scroll down long enough, there are tweets from gamers.
Amazing.
Where they use hashtag war crimes to describe anime accounts following them.
Of course.
So all in all, this is a very normal hashtag and a very normal curation of those hashtags.
I, the other night when I couldn't sleep, ended up following this extremely hostile and heated thread. It was just after everything kicked off between Azerbaijan and Armenia. But the thread was about whose women were hotter. And it was just these, and just like all these people involved, just like chucking pictures back and forth of sort of different kind of either Azeri or Armenian sort of actors, models, etc., etc., etc. And I was just sort of reading this, thinking, is this a good way of handling it? Because I can see the pros and the cons of this as a conflict mediation tactic.
Yeah.
There's some very beautiful women on this thread.
Yeah.
From both sides. Very beautiful women.
I'll put out a poll on our Twitter about who's hotter.
No, who's do not. Armenian. Oh my God, are you fucking nuts? Who else do you want to come after us? Fucking hell.
I'm just imagining like the end of like the Avengers movies, where like the armies that come against you are like BTS stans, Armenians and Azeris, and like for some reason like what's left of like the RAND Corporation.
smash cut to you on my behalf challenging President of Turkey Erdogan to a fight. Like that's what's gonna happen.
That's right. That's right. I mean, look, we aren't like, you know, we aren't a good podcast until like we are denounced by the president of Turkey. So until then, I won't be stopping.
Okay. I think we can I think we can definitely leave it there.
That's right. That's right. We are not doing the poll. We're not doing the poll.
We're not doing circumstance to be doing the poll.
That's right. However, you can follow us again. You can follow me, H. Kasvani, on Twitter. Phoebe, you can follow Phoebe at...
Phoebe underscore Rosa underscore Holly on the old Insta, where I do not
yeah,
post.
Give us yeah send us some feedback and stuff. It'll be fun. Obviously, obviously, like bell fun links in the episode description. If there's anything you want me to add, like let me know. And until then, we will catch you soon.
And happy Halloween! Don't get spooked.
Yes, happy Halloween. Happy Pagans Holiday.
Bye. Oh,